You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, what kind of mask is the best to wear, and how often are we supposed to wash them? We talk practical advice and tips with two Wisconsin experts to get some answers. Now, our next guest says there's growing evidence that the molecules necessary for life were formed in the space between stars. The astrophysicist and author is teaching kids and adults about our intricate relationship with the entire universe. Ray Jayawathalna is a professor of astronomy at Cornell University and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences there. He's written a picture book for kids called Child of the Universe. He talked about it with WPR host Keely Boltina.
In one of the first few pages of your book, a father tells his child, "The universe conspired to make you." What an incredible statement in a world where sometimes we wonder, why am I here?
Indeed, the idea is to inspire a sense of wonder about how we are connected to the rest of the cosmos. So the book really tries to highlight the deep and enduring links between the universe at large and us on this little planet Earth, while also evoking a sense of wonder in kids about the universe beyond and inspiring a sense of grand possibilities for themselves.
Then how do you connect what we know about the physical makeup of the universe to the makeup of our bodies, of our world?
Those connections are real and based on scientific discoveries. To begin with, the long popular idea that we are stardust, that the atoms that make up our bodies and our planet were cooked inside stars that lived and died long ago. So right from that elemental point on, there's so many connections between what we are and what's out there beyond the thin sliver of air that surrounds the Earth. Those connections go obviously a lot far beyond the elements themselves, in that in cold depths of interstellar space, there's growing evidence of more and more complex molecules forging. And there's evidence of asteroids and comets bringing water and other important molecules to the Earth, and perhaps even shaping evolution on our planet through devastating impacts like the one that probably wiped out the dinosaurs. And even today, the tidal forces of the moon impact tides in the Earth's oceans and may have had a role to play in the evolution of life from the ocean onto land. So these connections are multifaceted, and they are from long time ago to the present and into the future.
Sometimes we think about the world existing in the solar system and we don't think very far beyond that, but it's not just our sun. There are so many suns and so much out there. How should we think about that?
Well, just in the last 25 years, we've come a long way in making some sense of how our own Earth and our own solar system stack up relative to many others. Astronomers have identified several thousand worlds beyond our solar system just since the mid-1990s. So we've now have some sense of the incredible diversity of worlds out there. And we're beginning to look for evidence of life far beyond Earth. For now, the Earth is the only planet on which for sure we know there is life. But are we alone? That's one of the most profound and fundamental questions about our place in the universe. And we are closer than ever to being able to address that. We don't yet know whether life is common or rare.
Ray Jayawardhana is an astrophysicist and an author. His children's book is a story of love and also science. This is the Ideas Network. Ray, you search out in the universe. Your work can involve telescopes with magnificent power to see things far away. And yet this book is not full of photos from space. It's drawn. It's got bright colors, almost really personal images. Why did you make that choice?
Because the illustrator, Raul Colon, had a vision for the book that captured both the physical and the poetic in, I would say, spectacular ways, together with questions of mystery and complexity about the universe. We also wanted to show the little girl in the book at home in the universe, a sense that of grandeur and possibility for herself, but also in turn show that she embodies the universe in the ways that I described a bit earlier.
Do adults see the same things that young readers do, or do you hope that they notice or feel something different?
I hope that they are reminded of their youth and that sense of wonder and aspiration and excitement they may have once felt as children, looking up at the night sky or watching videos of astronauts on the moon and thinking about the vastness of the cosmos and our place in it. So I hope in many ways that both children and adults take away the same core message. I also hope that people take away the very strong sense of interconnectedness among all of us human beings right here on Earth. The fact that we are connected to the rest of the cosmos, but on this little rock of a world, we really are in it together for better and for worse. And if anything, the recent pandemic has highlighted and reminded us yet again our vulnerability, but also a sense of our collective ingenuity to extend our reach through spacecraft into the outer solar system and beyond, and to understand and deal with even terrible diseases.
You include an author's note that we shouldn't think of the universe as out there. Why should we change our perspective?
Because every single second of every day and night, we have trillions and trillions of neutrinos from the sun and beyond passing through our bodies, hardly leaving a trace ever, and yet we are bombarded by particles from beyond. That's just one teeny tiny example of our ongoing connections to the rest of the cosmos. And for another more dramatic reminder is aurorae, northern and southern lights, which are the result of solar flares interacting with the upper reaches of the Earth's atmosphere, reminding us that space weather, as we call it, affects the Earth. And as a technological society, if anything, we are more vulnerable to space weather now than we might have been a couple of hundred years ago, because the GPS system, satellite communications, air traffic, all of that could be affected by a solar storm.
How do you want us to use this book you've written as a conversation starter with our kids or maybe among other adults?
I hope it draws us to think bigger, broader, and more hopeful thoughts. It reminds us of the grandeur of all that's out there and that we're part of it all. That we share a planet with each other and are tied to it in so many ways, And yet our human audacity and reach could has brought us far and gives us hope for the future. So I hope at a time of distress and devastation in particular, this book provides a glimmer of positivity, hope, and aspiration.
Has it done that for you?
It certainly has, and I was thrilled to be able to surprise my 6-year-old daughter on her birthday with the first copy of the book.
What did she think?
Oh, she thought it was the coolest thing ever. The real reason for writing the book was to be a cooler dad, of course.
Of course. Makes total sense. Ray, thank you so much for your time today.
Great speaking with you, Keely. Thank you.
That was Ray Jayawarthana. He was talking with WPR host Keely Boltina, and they were discussing his new picture book for kids called Child of the Universe. Ray is an author and an astrophysicist. He's a professor of astronomy at Cornell University and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences there. Well, coming up, fans can't attend sporting events in person these days, but the NBA has a virtual crowd. We'll talk with someone who got to be one of the digital faces in the stands. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll find out what it's like to be one of the virtual fans on the screen at an NBA playoff game. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with the controversial history surrounding the ice cream sundae.
Wisconsin is the home to many firsts. The first blender, the first typewriter, and even malted milk was developed and introduced to the world right here in the Dairy State. Two Rivers is the home of the first ever ice cream sundae. Well, that last one is debated by some. Dean Robbins explains.
I like driving across Wisconsin to see legendary historical sites. I've planned whole trips around the Eau Claire baseball field where Hank Aaron got his start and the Janesville house where Abraham Lincoln spent the night. But every once in a while, I stumble across a bit of Wisconsin history I knew nothing about. That happened on a recent drive through the northeast part of the state when I pulled into Two Rivers. In Central Park, I noticed an official Wisconsin historical marker claiming it as the birthplace of the ice cream sundae. Coincidentally, my favorite dessert. Could such a major phenomenon have originated in this small town? According to the marker, a local man named George Hallauer walked into a soda fountain on 15th Street in 1881. He asked owner Edward Berner to top a dish of ice cream with chocolate sauce, a substance previously reserved for ice cream sodas. The new concoction caught on, and Berner began selling it for a nickel, but only on Sundays. Enter a 10-year-old girl who insisted on having a dish of ice cream with that stuff on top, on a different day of the week. That was out of the question for Berner, until the girl charmingly suggested that they pretend it was Sunday. That opened the floodgates, with the shopkeeper offering the dish every day in many flavors. The unusual spelling of Sunday started when a salesman placed an order for Berner's canoe-shaped dishes with his glassware company. He requested Sunday dishes with an E at the end rather than a Y, and the rest is history, or so says the state of Wisconsin. Is this amazing story for real? Standing there in Central Park, I searched for ice cream sundae origin on my phone. Sure enough, Two Rivers has rivals to the claim. The most aggressive challenger is Ithaca, New York, which points to a 19th century newspaper ad for a locally served sundae. In a New York Times article on the dispute, Ithaca's mayor sneered at Two Rivers, saying, "We have the historical documents, and they don't." Two Rivers refused to take that lying down. The city passed a resolution demanding that Ithaca cease and desist with its Sunday slanders. Residents also deluged Ithaca's mayor with postcards picturing the Wisconsin historical marker. On matters of milk fat, Ithaca surely learned that you crossed the Dairy State at your peril. So what's the truth? To gather crucial evidence, I strolled to the Two Rivers Visitor Center in an 1850s inn. You can bet the complex houses a soda fountain, named after local hero Edward Berner. Purely for the sake of historical research, I ordered an ice cream sundae. Was it a descendant of the world's first sundae, served here in 1881? Sorry, Ithaca, but I have no documentation. All I'll say is that, with its thick chocolate sauce, overflowing whipped cream, and juicy cherry, the dish made me a believer.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. He's won state and national awards for arts, features, and news stories, and has contributed to magazines and newspapers around the country. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, pro sports leagues have found some creative ways to fill the stands during the COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen cardboard cutouts, giant teddy bears, and in the NBA, digital faces watching on screens inside the arena. Those virtual fans aren't just recordings. They're live connections with people watching from their homes. And our next guest got to try this out when she attended a game between the Philadelphia 76ers and the Boston Celtics. Kate Nibbs is a senior writer at Wired covering culture. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, even though they are projecting these people into the stadium, it's not like there are the same number of seats. There are only about 300 or so of these virtual spots for each game. How did you get one?
So I got very lucky because I'm a reporter for Wired. And so I tweeted that I thought it would be more fun if the NBA had cartoon animals in the stands. And as someone from Michelob, which is the sponsor of this like virtual courtside experience, I think they saw my tweet. They didn't tell me exactly, but they reached out and said, why don't you try the experience? And so that is how I very luckily wound up as one of those heads.
So diss the idea, get a seat for the game. So how does the actual connection work? How are you watching the game?
So you need your laptop, and then you have to download Microsoft Teams, which I was actually unfamiliar with because we use Google at Wired. And so you download the app, and then Microsoft created this sort of new user interface called Together Mode. It was actually created to help Stephen Colbert host The Late Show remotely, and then they've sort of expanded its use since the pandemic started. And it just helps you, it makes sort of the teleconferencing experience more immersive. And so I was sitting there, and my husband got to be my plus one, so he was lucky. So we had two laptops next to each other with this Microsoft Teams, and then it basically took our webcams and recorded us, and then it put us in this sort of virtual auditorium, and then it looked, you know, if you've been watching these basketball games and seeing the heads, it looks like people were sitting in the stands.
So for people who haven't seen it, give us a sense of like, what's the quality of the images that we're seeing of you and other attendees?
They're definitely kind of pixelated. It's not, they haven't really ironed out the definition exactly. But it's just sort of these little pixelated heads. I honestly did not realize that they were live streamed until I got to do this experience. Yeah, it kind of looks like a video art. I don't know if anyone has been to downtown Chicago. There's this big installation, and mm-hmm. it's people's faces.
Yep.
Spouting water. You know what I'm talking about? It kind of looks
absolutely
like that.
Yep. Okay. Well, and it's funny because you found out that if you moved in certain ways, you could make it look like your leg was actually your husband's arm or mm-hmm. something like that.
Yes, we were definitely playing around because I really wanted to get my dog in on TV. So we were like having our dog sit on our laps, and because we were sitting next to each other, when the dog would cross from my lap to his, it looked like it was jumping rows on the virtual screen. So it was pretty surreal and funny.
Well, and also, you know, there were people like you in your section. You said there were quite a few journalists, but mm-hmm. if people are paying attention, there's some pretty famous faces. And I find this so funny. Even in a digital setting, there are the VIPs, and your husband actually got digitally bumped from his seat by someone that you actually probably weren't too upset about him being bumped by. Who was that?
Yes, I'm from Chicago, so I was extremely excited. Scottie Pippen was in our section, and
that's
so
awesome.
Was BJ Armstrong, another former Bull star. And yeah, so Scottie did want to be in the front row, which I cannot blame him. He deserves it. But my husband got booted to the back row so Scottie could take his rightful place of prominence.
But let's reiterate, this is a virtual front row.
Yes.
but you know, you felt like Scottie had earned that, and you know he always kind of got overlooked a little bit with the amazing players he played with. So you were actually pretty pro Scottie in this.
Yes, always pro Scottie Pippen. He can do no wrong in my eyes, so I was fine with that. But yeah, it was pretty fun. I mean, I've never had a seat that good in a real basketball game before, so I've never sat near a celebrity of that caliber. So I was pretty psyched.
So we're seeing the floating heads, but what are you seeing actually?
So you see a split screen. One half is a live stream of the basketball game. And then the other half is, it sort of looks like what you see, but it's a different kind of digital auditorium. It's hard to honestly describe just because it's something I've never really seen before, but it's basically just everyone's heads put together in a virtual seating area.
So I think this is hilarious. One of the things that happens in a real sporting event, love it or hate it, is the wave. And that happened, and it was just like in real life. There were people that were clearly not into it and not, you know, basically doing the minimum. I think that's really funny that you can't even escape things like the wave when you're digital.
No, we really could not. We did it several times, and I honestly liked it, though, because it simulated what it's like to go to a sporting event way more than I thought. I had pretty low expectations for the experience, to be honest, and it did exceed those low expectations because I felt like I was part of a social gathering, which I have not felt like that for a while. I'm calling you from my house in New York, which is where I spend most of my time, and it was kind of novel and fun to feel like I was in a public space, even though it wasn't really a public space.
Yeah. Well, Kate, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your experience.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Kate Nibbs is a senior writer at Wired covering culture. She talked with us about her experience as one of the digital floating heads in the virtual crowd at an NBA playoff game. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. Tomorrow after 8 on The Morning Show, for years, talk show host Charlie Sykes was a driving force in Wisconsin's conservative politics. But since President Trump's election, he's been working with other disaffected conservatives to prod the GOP into a new direction. He shares his views on the 2020 campaign, Wisconsin's Republican leaders, and the violence in Kenosha. That's tomorrow after 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, in the last few months, it's become clear that mask wearing is something that is here to stay for the indefinite future. Having just one mask no longer seems to be an option. With so many mask options to choose from and a variety of opinions on what type is best, it can be hard to choose. And once we have the masks, there are a lot of questions on proper care, how to wash them, how often to wash them, and more. We have two guests joining us now to talk about choosing and caring for our face masks. Majid Sarmadi is the Rothmel Bascom Professor in the School of Human Ecology, where he directs the graduate-level textile science specialization in the Design Studies program. He also works with students in the Materials Science graduate program. Majid, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and hello to everyone.
Thanks for being with us. And Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, an associate editor for the social media-based science communication campaign Dear Pandemic, in which she and 9 other female PhD-trained scientists curate the latest scientific information and guidelines related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Amanda, great to have you back on Central Time.
Thanks for having me today, Judith.
Well, Majid, let's start with you. We'd like to kind of compare and rate different types of masks. What have you found is the most or some of the better types of textiles to use in cloth masks?
The best things to use is polypropylene or PP, and that one is a non-woven material. And the thing is, you want to create three-layer mask. And when you create your three-layer mask, every layer acts as a wall of defense for you. And what you want to do is, after you put the three layers together, and it should be pleated in a way that opens up and covers your nose and your chin very comfortably. And it should have a metal, not plastic, nose piece. The metal nose piece will help to shape it around your nose to cover, to seal the breathing area. And you should take the mask in front, you know, and look at the light source or look at around. You should have enough light that doesn't look totally 100% opaque. But if you recognized any shape, any form, then the mask is not good enough to protect you. It has too open of structure. You want to stay with synthetic fiber or man-made fiber such as polypropylene, because it does not absorb moisture, it does not swell, it doesn't clog the pores that you breathe through, and when you are wash and clean it, it dries faster.
Now, a lot of people are making cloth masks out of, say, you know, leftover fabric from sewing projects, things like that. They are often doing more than one layer. But from what you said, I'm concerned that those are maybe not as good as we think they are.
I always say any protection is better than none, as long as you don't become overconfident and become careless. You always have to maintain, even with the mask, maintain your distance with the other people, minimum of 6 feet, even you have the mask. Any protection is better than none. The cotton material, if it's too old, you don't want to get it from your grandma's chest and use them. For one reason is, many of them has different chemicals on them that now we are not using them on textile material anymore. And then in the presence of moisture, they may release and may give you a problem. One of them is formaldehyde, for example, that they may cause problem, especially if the fabric was wash and wear or easy iron or durable press or some of those things, or some of them were having flame retardant on them when it was cotton. If you wanted to use cotton, buy brand new untreated cotton material rather than use any old ones that you do not know what type of a treatment was on it, because it may cause contact dermatitis for some people. And we talk about contact dermatitis. A few months ago on public radio, if you recall.
And Amanda, I want to ask you about the style of masks and ways of not spreading the virus to others. One of the styles that there's been conflicting information out about is the gator style. And this, if people have seen it, it looks kind of like almost like a big sock, kind of. It starts at your nose, but then it goes all the way down onto your neck. And so it's kind of a scarf and a mask put together, or a collar almost. Are those good at preventing transmission of COVID-19?
I think what we want to focus on is the number of layers of fabric. And so a gator mask can be an effective mask, but we want it to be made of the right material, a tightly woven material. And a lot of these gaiters are used, you know, pre-pandemic for running or for sports, and so they kind of tend to be a stretchier material. And so if the gaiter itself is made from multiple layers of tightly woven fabric, then it can serve a similar function, I think, to a cloth face mask that fits, you know, with ear loops. So I would focus on the number of layers and deciding.
That's good to know, because there was at least, you know, one article that was floating around saying gaiters might be worse than nothing at all. So you're saying that's probably
the
not
the study
true.
That came out was really assessing the mechanics to be able to test masks. It wasn't intended to be a study of mask efficacy. And so I think the headlines kind of ran with that, mm-hmm. but we can refocus on just thinking about the multiple layers and having a gaiter that meets that criteria.
One of the problem with them is that it doesn't cover the nose. It doesn't attach to around your nose, and therefore it doesn't create a seal. Hmm. And therefore you have lots of air go up and down and those things, you know, when you are breathing, and doesn't filter the air. So that's one of my problem with them. And again, if you are using them, take them and see if you can see the light and recognize any shapes. If you recognize any shape, it's not good. I had one of my colleagues wearing a mask that I could see she has a very nice red lipstick on. And I said, you know, you got to change it immediately. So you know what I mean? You know, mask available. So you shouldn't be able to do that.
One more question about kind of the style of masks. Chuck on Facebook said, please compare the pros and cons of masks that loop around the ears. Those are the ones with elastic, and masks that tie behind the head. Majid, do you have any advice there for Chuck?
I like the one that loop around your head better, because they create a better seal, but they are not as easy to put them on and off, take them off. So some people don't like it. Personally, I think they are good. The masks are very individual people. Some people may be more comfortable wearing masks with the ear loops. And you got to make sure that doesn't cause too much pressure on your ear loops. Otherwise, you get tired. You constantly touch your mask to adjust it, and that causes your hand to be contaminated. You don't want to do that. And you touch your face and those things. If the mask coming down, you want to push it up, that's not good. So, please see which one you are more comfortable mm-hmm. with and use that one. Use a mirror to see if it's sealing around your nose, if it's sealing around your cheeks, if it's sealing around your chin, you know, mm-hmm. use a mirror. And then that's the right size mask for you. And
so the seal is the most important. If we can use the ones with the ties, but if we can get a good seal with the elastic around the ears, those are okay.
Those are fantastic too.
Okay, great. We are talking with Amanda Simonik, an associate professor of epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee. We also have Majid Sarmadi, a professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. We are talking about the best types of masks to wear and how to care for them. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about choosing the right kinds of masks, how often they can be reused, and how to care for them? Have you found a mask style that you like a lot? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We are continuing our conversation about caring for your face masks, and we have two guests with us. Amanda Simonik is an associate professor of epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee, and Majid Sarmadi is a professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 1234. Do you have questions about finding the best face masks? Are you wondering how to keep it clean? And have you found a mask that works for you and want to recommend it to others? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. And I have a question. So how often should we be washing a cloth mask, or is it enough to let it air out if we are letting it sit for long enough that the virus, if we had come in contact with it, would die? Amanda, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, I think you should treat your mask, you know, as a single-use mask. You know, if you're going out to the grocery store and you wear it, then I would come back home, take it off, and put it into the wash. If you're going out to have a picnic with friends, you know, and you're trying to maintain social distance and wear masks, you might wear it for a while, then take it off to eat. It's okay to put it back on. What you want to keep in mind is if the mask is getting damp from your respirations, then it's going to become more difficult to breathe through the mask and it's going to become less effective. So that can be a good sign that, hey, I should switch my mask. You know, maybe if you're going to be out for a few hours or you're working and wearing a mask, you want to have a few on hand to be able to change them throughout the day. If you are going to take off your mask, you want to, you know, remove it by the earlobes. You want to fold the outside portion on top of itself to keep the contaminated portion closed. And then you can bring along a paper bag or a plastic bag and store it inside there. And after you take that off and you put it in the bag, you want to use hand sanitizer or wash your hands before you would be eating or doing anything else. And that way, you know, you don't want to throw your mask that you've been wearing into your purse or your backpack or, you know, the passenger seat of your car. You want to put it into a place where it's not going to contaminate any surfaces or anybody, right? And then take it back out, put it on, and use hand sanitizer again.
So airing it out is not enough because it could compromise how well it's working.
Well, I think you'd need to do that for a few days. And, you know, they do say you could do that and put the mask out into the sun. But just having it sit out for 10 minutes, you know, next to you while you're eating outside is not going to be sufficient for that.
Okay. I'll say what I do is I have a few different cloth masks and I kind of have a rotation. And so no one mask is being, and I've been airing them out more than washing them because we just don't do laundry that often. But I've been letting them air out for at least, I'd say, 4 to 5 days. Is that maybe helping a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you don't do laundry often, you can hand wash your mask in soap and water and then leave it to dry out. And that would be more, I think, effective than just leaving it out to dry in the air.
And Majid, is there any concern about compromising the fabric itself if we wash it too much?
No, depends to the type of a fabric. But I wanted to add something. And that one is your mask is even you put it outside to sun and something to disinfect that, but your mask acts as a filter, like your dryer filter at your washer and or your filter on your air conditioning system. It gathers junks or pollens and dust. Therefore, if you don't wash your cloth mask regularly, it clogs the pores and make your respiration more difficult. Therefore, you shouldn't only try to disinfect it, but wash it and always wash it inside out. Because when you are washing it inside out, if you are not putting it in laundry, let the water run to take the debris out of material rather than lodge them inside to close the pores and they be trapped over there. So therefore, if you are washing by hand, run warm water goes from one side to another one inside, you know, goes the other direction to take everything that is on this surface out rather than push them inside
the mask. That is a great point. I would not have thought about that.
And then remember, if you are buying a brand new fabric and you wash it, it may shrink. We have relaxation shrinkage and we have swelling shrinkage and progressive shrinkage that goes constantly through. And it may make your breathing a little bit difficult if it's too close. So you see where is your comfort level. You are breathing, you can see barely some light, and you are comfortable breathing. And as long as doing that, and as long as the elastic is not giving up on you, some of the elastic become too loose or too tight.
So we should keep an eye on that. We are talking with Majid Sarmadi of UW-Madison and Amanda Simonek of UW-Milwaukee about the best types of masks to buy and use and how to take care of them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones. And Nancy in Grafton is up. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, I got an idea. I've got those masks, you know, that come from the doctor's office. Anyhow, but I need windshield washers now for my glasses. Gosh darn it, they get fogged up. And there I am with foggy glasses. And what kind of mask would work better, or do I have to get windshield washers for my glasses?
I feel your pain, Nancy. I only wear reading glasses, but of course, in a grocery store or something, I need to be able to read things, and I have the same thing. I don't know, either of you, Majid or Amanda, would you like to take that?
I can take that. Nancy, that's a great question, and I think, you know, someone probably will patent that invention now that you said that. But you can wear your mask up higher on your nose so that your glasses rest on top of the mask. And if you have that metal, you know, bar in the mask that you've pinched tight across the bridge of your nose, and you've really made that fit of the mask snug across your cheeks, wearing your glasses so they, and I do wear glasses, but so that they rest over the mask brim is going to help prevent that fogging up of your glasses.
And Majid, do you want to add anything?
Yes, and I want to say, if your glasses are fogging too much, it means there is no seal on above your nose, and you are leaking too much air from that point. So, therefore, your mask is not good.
Or not fitting well.
Okay.
Fitting well, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to know. Thank you for bringing that up, Nancy. And let's go back to the phones. And Nan in Madison is up. Hi, Nan.
Hi. I'm sorry if this has been already answered, but I obviously a disposable paper mask is a one-time use. But how long does the virus live on paper, and how long does it live on fabric?
Thanks for that call, Nan. So a single-use paper mask, is it really a single-use, or does it depend on how long we're using it? Amanda?
Again, I would follow the same rule that if you're wearing it and it starts to become damp because of your breath and your respirations, that it would be time to replace it, you know, or if you're wearing it long enough that it's sort of stretching out or not fitting. But I would consider that a single-time, you know, use mask.
Okay. We don't have a whole lot of time left, but one thing that I really want to see if we can get some clarity on is when all of this started and we were being encouraged to wear masks, and now it's mandated in some situations, it was very much about protecting others, not transmitting the virus. But Amanda, I'll ask you as an epidemiologist, are we also protecting ourselves? Is it protecting us as much as we're protecting others?
You're right that the main purpose back, you know, in April when the Centers for Disease Control made the recommendation that in the community setting we wear masks was really for source control, to limit the number of droplets that I expel out into the environment that could potentially infect other people. I think as more people in the community wear them, we do all benefit from mask use. There's some, you know, evidence from some studies in different situations where, you know, both people wearing masks has prevented infections, whether that's in a hair salon or on an airplane. And we have, you know, evidence growing that the infectious dose that you may get exposed to when you're around people who wear masks might be lower. You know, so even if we're not preventing all droplets or all particles from entering into the environment, we're reducing that amount, and that can have an effect on the level of infection in the community.
And briefly, go ahead.
I like to emphasize here, please do not use the mask with a valve on them, because those masks do not protect the community. It may protect you when you are exhaling all droplets go outside and contaminate your environment.
Well, so much great information. Thank you both for joining us. Majid, thanks so much.
Sure.
Thank you.
And Amanda, yeah, thanks for joining us once again. Majid Sarmadi is a professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, where he directs the graduate-level textile science specialization. He also works with students in the materials science graduate program. And Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's also associate editor for the social media-based science communication campaign called Dear Pandemic. They both joined us to talk about choosing the best mask for you and caring for those masks. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 7, compared to countries like Singapore and South Korea, COVID-19 data in the U.S. is lacking. A data expert joins Kate Archer Kent to explain why national data on the disease isn't quickly and easily accessible in the U.S. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.